The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Is this a rhetorical question?
What's moronic about an oxymoron?
And what are the three ways you can be ironic?
From the ABCs of Abecedarius to the Zs of Zugma, we'll hit the books, make a speech, and discuss the origins of literary and rhetorical devices on Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of the etymology books Once Upon a Word and Words from Hell. And today we are headed back to English class to discuss literary and rhetorical devices, are we not?
Yes, we are. This is how to write and how to talk pretty, I think you could say. And I think it's going to be an unflipping believably good episode filled with all kinds of mad jargon, much of which I did not know before researching this episode. But Jess, you've done a lot of research on this stuff in the past. You've written about it. So I'm going to let you take the lead here. What are we getting into when we get into rhetoric and literary devices?
A lot of the words that we will discuss today are jargon. They are literary and rhetorical jargon, but they're very old. This is not a new thing. They weren't invented for your English class. They date back to Greek rhetoric and analysis of the art of speech and discourse and analysis of theater and poetry dating back to ancient Greece. We have this gap here because this was applied to Roman literature, rhetoric, oratory, but then it sort of dropped off in the medieval era after the fall of the Roman Empire. And then later,
Dark Ages that we're not supposed to call the Dark Ages.
Right, of course. And then we get like Enlightenment era folks revisiting and Renaissance era folks revisiting some of these art forms and literary forms and then applying them across other pieces of literature, other forms of poetry, other forms of discourse and speech.
Right. And what happens during the Renaissance, etc., is that a lot of new Latinate or Greek sounding terms get invented. But what we're talking about here a lot of the time are words that were actually used by the Greeks and by the Romans, because they did critique their own speeches and their own modes of writing, and they had terms for the minutiae of the elements that were within these speeches, the rhetoric that they used. And we're going to get into so much of that. I'm sure I'm going to get tongue-tied, but let's get into it. Let's start, I think, with the literary devices that people will be most aware of, I think, and then we'll get more granular as we go along.
So words like simile and metaphor, we all know these, but they illustrate your point very well because they came to English during the Renaissance with the rise of post-classical literary theory and criticism. A metaphor is originally a Greek word, metaphora, meaning a transfer or a carrying over. It carries one meaning to another through a form of imagery or something like that. Meanwhile, a simile, it's the same thing, but using the terms like or as. So in East of Eden, we've got like the line, Kate inched over her thoughts like a measuring worm. That's our simile. And then in Hitchhiker's Guide, we have the ships hung in the sky much in the same way that bricks don't, which is sort of an anti-simile, you might say.
I remember the lesson at school on this very well, where they said, okay, so if it's got like to tell you that it's like something, then you're dealing with a simile and it's saying that it is similar to something. That was how they planted that word simile in our heads, just to say it like that. Whereas a metaphor, you are, for all intents and purposes, saying the thing is this other thing. You are transferring it to something else, as the etymology suggests.
One of my favorite examples is in Call of Cthulhu, Lovecraft's work. He says, "We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity."
Ooh, nice. I like that.
I love existential horror. It's so much fun.
I came across a word that means a mixed metaphor as well. The word I'm talking about is catachresis. I don't know if you know this word. It means basically to mess up, right? It's bad expression, bad speech. And so really you can apply it to anyone doing a bad job of speaking, full stop. But it tends to these days get applied to mixed metaphors.
One of my favorites is they come up in idioms a lot. Like, we'll burn that bridge when we come to it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's when you've mixed your idioms as well, right?
These are also called malaphors, right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's quite specifically when you do it with, yeah, two metaphors, that two commonly used ones that you merge together. The Merriam-Webster website gives an example. If we want to get ahead, we'll have to iron out the remaining bottlenecks. And you can hear people doing this, and kind of absentmindedly, you do hear mixed metaphors quite frequently, because sometimes a metaphor is so embedded into the cliches of how we speak that you don't even notice it is one, and that you are not therefore extending it as you continue on to whatever the next thought is.
Our episode on corporate jargon, we did that a lot.
Oh,
we
yes.
We were combining 100-pound or 800-pound gorillas with opening kimonos, yeah, and all kinds of things.
That's it, the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Simile and metaphor, they're some of the big hitters. Another of the really big hitters when we're talking about literary devices and that we learn about at school is irony, of course. And in Britain, we like to think that we're so darn good. Irony. And I'm not being ironic. I mean it. Sarcasm, form of irony, sardony. But actually, you can break irony down into three sort of categories, can't you?
Right. Sarcasm is verbal irony, like when you say you're so excited to pay your mortgage this month. Ironic or oxymoronic similes, which are often sarcastic, fall into this bucket too. Like if you call something as clear as mud, but verbal irony doesn't necessarily have to be self-aware. If you were to angrily yell that you're not angry, that's also verbal irony.
Yeah, but that is also sort of an ironic action as well, which links us into one of the other types of irony, doesn't it?
Are we talking situational irony?
Situational irony, yeah, exactly. An angry person. It's an ironic situation to see an angry person shouting how not thoroughly not angry I am, actually.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's plenty of examples of situational irony. They often turn up in plays, but also you can just observe them in your life. Okay, so the song Ironic by Alanis Morissette, she cites a load of what would be, if they were genuinely ironic, would be situational ironies. You know, having 10,000 spoons when all you need is a knife. Oh, goodness, there's so many spoons. Should I try and be charitable here and say in there is a kind of world where that is ironic?
I lean not that way, but...
I think there is. Having a surplus of one thing... No, I can't get there. I'm sorry. I was trying to be nice.
I feel like the irony of that song is its claim to demonstrate irony.
yeah. And again, that's just inner propriety, isn't it?
Right. Internal consistency.
Yeah, an inaptronym.
Right, exactly. It's good. Maybe that was the intention the whole time.
Oh, a really good example of this, by the way, because Shakespeare is kind of the irony god.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Dramatic irony, but also situational irony. A really good example. It's a sad one, but the people will be aware of it, is at the end of Romeo and Juliet, when Romeo takes the poison so that he can join Juliet in death. It's ironic that he does that because she isn't dead. And so he ends up abandoning her in life, when what he was actually trying to do was unite with her and accompany her. But that is also an example of dramatic irony, that situation, because we as the viewer know what is going on because we know that Juliet isn't dead. Explain to us a bit more about dramatic irony.
that's the key distinction between situational and dramatic irony, is we understand what's happening and the full implications of what a character is doing, no matter how bad it's going to be. My favorite example is Othello. Iago tells us about his scheme to bring about Othello's downfall by making it seem like Desdemona has been unfaithful and Othello doesn't know any of this. So all of his actions are examples of dramatic irony.
Yeah.
The situational irony bit, it can involve like knowing that this is happening, but it can also have like a twist to it. Like in Macbeth, we are more surprised to see the way the witch's prophecy plays out in unexpected ways, like the movement of the wood to the castle and things like that.
So we know that Macbeth is, and he knows that he's going to end up killing Duncan to become king, because that is what the witches have told him. So we're aware that that is his destiny as spoken by the witch, but Duncan isn't. And so Duncan is constantly talking about Macbeth in these glowing terms. "He was a gentleman on whom I built an absolute trust," he says, which is a lesson in dramatic irony, because we're all going,
yeah, right.
Really? You're going to trust this guy?
In case Shakespeare is like, I don't know, not your jam for whatever reason. I'm a big fan, but I'm not going to judge.
Yeah, it's not for everyone.
A great example of situational irony that kind of illustrates the distinction is The Wizard of Oz. It's full of situational irony. Dorothy's three companions have the qualities that they want from the wizard already and demonstrate it through their actions.
Oh, that's sweet. And so that's a form of dramatic irony.
That is situational irony.
That's situational irony. I see. Yeah, okay, I'm getting
because it is a reversal of expectations, particularly on the part of the character.
I'm not actually sure that at school they were technically correct when they told me this, but they said that maybe it's just a form of dramatic irony. But you know when someone kind of foreshadows their own death, for example, they say, well, you know, well if he doesn't win, may God strike me down. And then, you know, the character just does end up dying.
Right.
You know, it's a form of dramatic irony, but it's not. It's not quite the same. It doesn't fall into those criteria that we've talked about the audience being knowing. So I'm not quite sure where that one falls.
I would love to talk about paradoxes and oxymorons.
So oxymoron is when you have two contradictory concepts.
Essentially, it is a brief paradox, a term that is made up of words that, without context, contradict one another.
My cat is disgustingly cute.
Something like that. Yeah, the classic ones are like tight slacks and jumbo shrimp, where the words themselves contradict one another, but they have to lack the context around them, because, of course, you understand what those two terms mean. Another one is like passive aggressive is, in a sense, an oxymoron.
Right. But what's interesting about these is they all make perfect sense, right? That it's perfectly possible to hold these two ideas in your head at once. There's, by the way, another concept that sits alongside oxymorons, a little bit more complex, but one that I wasn't aware of until earlier this week. An Australian lawyer got in touch with me and said, "Have you heard of this phenomenon, hendiadys?"
Ooh, I don't know this one.
It literally means one by means of two. So one from two. And the construction of a hendiadys is always something and something. And the way that it fits in with this idea of one by means of two is it's when we use two objects or two actions to describe a single one, usually unnecessarily. The reason this lawyer got in touch with me was he was annoyed by such legal phrases as cease and desist. The law doesn't particularly treat the ceasing and the desisting as separate things. Really, it's just kind of flannel that they've used these two terms to really get across just one point, one thing that they want you to do. Or if they describe something as being misleading and deceptive, that is a stock phrase. And it just covers all bases, but really they're just trying to focus on one thing. But another form of this is when, for example, if I stay in on a Saturday night rather than go out, and I'm just in front of the TV, I've maybe got, I don't know, some ice cream or a popcorn, and I'm feeling nice and cozy.
Oh, hey, there you go. You can do that with nice and a lot of things.
Yeah, but what I actually am is nicely cozy is the idea that I'm trying to put across. Actually, the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, has a good description of what it means. It's a figure of speech in which two words are connected by a conjunction in order to express a single complex. And it goes with nice and warm as the example instead of nicely warm. Yeah, hendiadys. loosely linked with the idea of an oxymoron.
Before we move on from this topic, I did want to get into the origins of paradox and oxymoron, because they're kind of interesting. I don't think we addressed that a paradox is an ostensibly self-contradictory scenario. So it's an oxymoron is that in like two words, but it's a contradiction, essentially. It literally means contrary to opinion, paradoxa. The second part there is like to appear, to seem, or to think. But oxymoron itself is also an oxymoron because it means sharp, dull, or clever, stupid.
Yeah.
Depending on how you translate it.
Yeah, the oxy is the same as in oxygen, obviously, which is, you know, the sharp generator, the acid generator. It's related to words like acute, angle. These are all relatives of the oxy and oxymoron.
You can almost use them to make jokes too. Like, I don't know, poke fun at the idea of like business ethics being an oxymoron or military intelligence. That was a George Carlin one.
Yeah, I like that one. I like that one. I included a list of them once in one of my newsletters. I'll have to find it. I'll dredge it out.
Excellent.
Oh, another of the big ones is the rhetorical question.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Are we going to talk about the rhetorical question?
Let's do it. Why not?
That wasn't one. That was just a straight up question. But, you know, I think there's quite a widespread confusion about rhetorical questions, because I've heard rhetorical question explained away as a question that doesn't need an answer. And that ultimately doesn't really get to the root of what a rhetorical question is. It is a question that is delivered for the sake of rhetoric. I mean, it just so happens that when you're giving a speech, you don't tend to expect the crowd to shout back, but sometimes they will. What about, are you not entertained?
There you go. I love it. That's perfect.
Are you not entertained?
Excellent. Yeah,
from Gladiator.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rhetorical question.
It is.
Can I talk about another biggie?
Let's do it.
Alliteration. I really like talking about alliteration, because alliteration is different to what we've talked about before, insofar as this is something that has been in English for a long time, that we've been talking about, but also deploying in English for a long time. Like, Old English is like the main way of expressing yourself through poetry is through alliteration, because rhyming doesn't become a characteristic of English poetry until after the French have turned up and have brought it over. Chaucer famously introduces one of the forms of rhyme, the rime royale, which is, it's got a weird sort of setup. It's A-B, A-B, B-B, C-C, something like that. Yeah, really weird layout. But it's amazing to think that Anglo-Saxon poetry doesn't rhyme, but it's actually advancing amazing amounts of alliteration instead. Beowulf, for example. The start of Beowulf is just littered with alliteration. Can I attempt to read it just to show you it?
Let's do it.
I'm not very good at the Old English pronunciation. I always have a go, but I don't tend to do it very well. So this might take a few goes and might just be a little bit cringe. But Beowulf begins, Hwat, hwe gardener in yardagum, theid cunninga thrym yfrunon, hu tha ethling as ellen fremedon. Wait for this bit. Oft should shaving share than a threatum monogum meathum merdosetler oft there a sode eorlas. So many repetitions of the sh, 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 the th, 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 the ma, ma, ma. They're all about the alliteration, the Anglo-Saxons.
Bravo. That was excellent. I was reminded the other day of a creator that I follow who specializes in Old and Middle English. She pointed out that everyone has like a regular Old English voice where you like read normally. And then you also have your Beowulf voice, which is a lot more dramatic. And I feel like you just did your Beowulf voice right there.
I quite enjoy the Old English voice that we put on. It's very grand. It's very visceral. But the Middle English voice you have to put on is really embarrassing if you never found it. It's like you have to put on this sort of weird, oh, blardy, blardy accent. I was talking about Chaucer, and as I was doing the research, I was thinking, okay, I'll read out a little bit of Chaucer as well to show how he used rhyme. And then I looked at it and I went, I'm not going to do that. I sound ridiculous when I read out Middle English.
I mean, like, the intro to the Canterbury Tales is very bouncy, right? It's the one that April with the shore is sota, the Dr. Bart hath persed to the rota, you know?
Now, you're so good at this. Go on, do it for us.
All right. Let me make sure I have all of it. It's one that April with the shore is sota, the Dr. March hath persed to the rota, and bather every vein in switch liquor of which vertu engendered is the floor. And I forgot the next line.
Nevertheless, we get the point there, don't we? And Chaucer is one of the first people expounding or using rhyme in English poetry. I mean, he spends a lot of time with French merchants. He's picking all of this stuff up from the French, and he's introducing specific rhyme schemes. And all of a sudden, the value of a poem, how good it is based around how well it rhymes. I mean, the French have terms like rime riche and rime pauvre, which mean poor and rich rhyme, and a rich rhyme is like three syllables that rhyme at the end of a line. You're like, oh, that's a corker of a rhyme. That is a rime pauvre, a poor one. It's like, you only managed to rhyme one syllable at the end. Poetry changes completely, but I'm actually really into the alliteration. Mm-hmm. I try to squeeze it in. If you read anything that I've written, it's tedious how much alliteration I squeeze in there.
Tedious, but also trippingly tenacious.
Tremendously tedious. To also work in an oxymoron.
I'm not qualified to talk about this subject, but there is a really wonderful YouTube video that I have watched before on the topic of how different kinds of rhymes work in hip hop. And I really love that subject. It's so interesting to learn about.
Are you not going to rap for us, Jess?
No, oh, absolutely not. Nobody wants that.
Very disappointing. Very disappointing. You have sort of substratum of alliteration as well. You have assonance, which is the repetition of vowel sounds, which actually, when I talk about Anglo-Saxons advancing amazing amounts of alliteration, that's a form of assonance as well. Or sibilance, where we do a lot of sounds, which was very present in that that Beowulf quote.
And sibilance is a sub-form of consonants, right?
Yeah, and alliteration, by the way, the litter in there is, you can read it as the word letter, right? And al at the start of that is a variant on the prefix ad. So it augments the letter. It stresses the letter. Basically, it's adding to the letters. What you're doing is you're really making a big deal out of whatever letter it is that you are repeating. That is,
I sure love Z's today.
I'm so into pa today. Please, please, please present me with more pa's.
Dazzled.
Oh, my microphone would have liked that. Sorry.
You know, what we could be a fun one to do next would be an analogy.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So we're onto something that we could have kind of talked about around similes and metaphors, right?
An analogy is a big simile or a big metaphor, so to speak. In the words of Britta from Community, which is one of my favorite shows of all time, it's like a thought with another thought's hat on.
Yeah, exactly. And then you get allegory, which is an even bigger one, right? Where you've got people talking about walking through the valley of the shadow of death. I'm talking about John Bunyan and Pilgrim's Progress, which is sort of a big allegory. He's on a journey, but what it actually is life, right? The valley of the shadow of death is experiencing death.
An interesting aspect of this is the Greek analogia is a word for proportion or correspondence. It is a story that corresponds to either an experience that you have or a societal problem that needs a solution or a morality tale. So you can apply stories of like foxes and crows in a fabulous way to just tales about how we should behave in society.
Altogether, allegory, analogy, simile, metaphor, they show that we do like to express ideas by comparing them with another one.
The classic is Pilgrim's Progress for allegory, and then analogies can be a little bit smaller. They can be a Romeo and Juliet, that which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet.
So we talked about some of the big guns there, the 800-pound gorillas of the rhetoric world, the rhetorical world. Let's talk about some of the more obscure phenomena or things that you will have come across, you'll have noticed in speech, but you wouldn't have realized that there is a name for them. We can more or less, there's so many of them, we can pretty much do an A to Z of them. In fact, let's try and do that Jess?
I'll start us off with anastrophe because I think this has come up before. And it goes with another one that doesn't start with an A, but we'll add an H on there too. It's anastrophe and hyperbaton. These are similar variations of the same thing. So hyperbaton describes an unusual word order that deviates from normal syntax for emphasis. And like the iconic example is to be or not to be, that is the question. And this is the beginning of Hamlet's soliloquy. And the reason it is out of order is because is like, if you were just saying this out loud, you'd be like, the question is to be or not to be, if you were rephrasing that, but not in verse, like properly iambing your pentameters is often how we end up with this, but then also for dramatic effect.
Fitting meter is to blame for an awful lot of
right. these. But you can also incorporate this in your everyday speech. Like I might say something like, in the garden, I find the most peace. That's just an emphasis on garden. Even though I could say I find the most peace in the garden, and it means the same thing. Now, anastrophe is a form of hyperbaton that makes you sound like Yoda. You simply move one word and it changes it for dramatic effect, or in Yoda's case, to make it sound like he has a different speech pattern. Strong with the force you are, rather than you are strong with the force. I guess that shifts it around.
You do, in bad poetry, you come across that a lot, right? Where people swap the words around to try and get the rhyming word at the end, or just to get it to bounce along, right?
Patience I lack, short he was not, things like that.
Yeah, used correctly or used choicely, yeah.
And it means to turn upside down in Greek because you reverse the order of the sentence. Hyperbaton means stepping over or stepping beyond. So you're in another way, you're moving the words around. The way to remember this stuck with me from like high school English class. The way to remember what anastrophe is it sounds like astronomy, and astronomy reminds you of Yoda. So you remember that anastrophe is the way Yoda speaks.
That's actually going to work for me, Jess.
Yeah. Right? I've remembered it for like 20 years now.
Can I take us to another sort of doublet of strange Greek terms for rhetorical devices, also beginning with A, because you've got anaphora and epistrophe.
Yes.
Both of these are used an awful lot. You've come across them and they're very effective. Anaphora is where you use the same words at the start of repeated lines or you know, consecutive lines. And the best examples of this, two of them are in Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, where he does start multiple lines with, I have a dream that one day this nation, I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia. But also he later on says, let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring, let freedom ring, let freedom ring. That is anaphora, where you use the same words at the start of every line. And then epistrophe is where you use the same words at the end of every line or at the end of consecutive thoughts. The Gettysburg Address, Abraham Lincoln, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth. That is epistrophe. And then when you have both of those used in the same section, you get a third thing, which is called simplicity. And I did manage to find an example. This is a speech that has both anaphora and epistrophe in the same lines. Simplicity. For want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the rider was lost, etc., etc. So the for want of a is the anaphora and the was lost is the epistrophe.
She swallowed the spider to catch the fly.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That kind yeah, of yeah. Thing. That works particularly well there. There's also a name for the phenomenon where you take from the end of one line the first word for the next line. Do you understand what I mean? I don't know what that one is.
Anadiplosis.
Thank you. I knew you'd know it.
If I'm understanding your explanation correctly, but it's repeating the last word of one clause at the beginning of the next. So again, here we are with, you have like Martin Luther King, who has this beautiful oration and one of the most famous speeches of all time for very good reason. And I have Yoda again. and it's fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. That's anadiplosis, meaning a doubling back. A lot of these mean like a doubling back in various ways, or like moving stuff around. Turning upon is epistrophe as well. And then carrying back is anaphora.
Yeah, exactly. Carry back. repeat, and then
There's also antimetaboly. That means turning about. And that's when you repeat a phrase or sentence in reverse order. And then here we have another U.S. figure, John F. Kennedy. Ask not what you can do for your country. Ask, or the other way around. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
So these are all very highly effective rhetorical devices that do have a name.
In the same vein, we have asyndeton and polysyndeton. Are you familiar with these?
No.
They mean, asyndeton means unconnected and polysyndeton means many connections. So like the omission of conjunctions in particular. So here we're back to our conjunctions. And then polysyndeton is adding a bunch. The iconic example of asyndeton is I came, I saw, I conquered. You put no conjunctions in the middle and it's just a series. And then polysyndeton is from James Joyce, we lived and laughed and loved and left.
He's putting in extra ands. You don't need that many ands in a list. But anyone who's still at school, the next time that they tell you, you can't have two ands in a sentence.
James Joyce say, did it.
excuse me, actually, you can. It's a very effective rhetorical device. And it is called polysyndeton. Polysyndeton. I think I lived next door to a polysyndeton at one point.
Let's see. Another interesting one is leidetes, and it means plainness or simplicity in Greek. It's basically the negging of the rhetorical world. It's like when you're actually doing okay, but you're like, not bad. You negatize your positives. Or from like Beowulf, the translation, he was not unfamiliar with hardship. So saying not unfamiliar means that you are familiar, but it gives you extra emphasis on that.
Right. Okay. So someone asks, how did the exam go? Well, not ungood.
Not terrible.
Not ungood. One that is really quite difficult to pronounce is Temesis. Temesis.
Oh, yes.
T-M-E-S-I-S. It's also a very, very fun one in most circumstances.
Absolutely. One of my favorites.
I was gonna say unflipping believable. Why do you have to drop the F bomb in there? I've got fan bloody tastic, and I thought that was a bit near the knuckle, to be honest. My nan would slap me for saying that.
Oh no.
But this is the ramming of one word in the middle of another, or more than one word in the middle of another. Usually it is used in that fun way that we've just done there. This is a unflipping believably good episode of Words Unraveled. But also, there is a common example of it that it kind of gets on my wick. And it's when people say a whole nother, that is also an example of temesis.
That's also called an infix, when you put it in the middle of a word. And there's an argument that the F-bomb can be used as an infix in many occasions. And same with bloody.
And a whole another is also a re-bracketing thing, but we've talked about that.
Have we addressed metonymy and synecdoche? Because this came up on a previous episode.
I honestly couldn't tell you whether we've addressed it, because it's just this big mix of them in my head now.
Metonymy is when you substitute one word for a related term. So if you call the US government the White House, right, or when an astronaut calls NASA like Houston when they're calling back. Synecdoche is the same thing, but when you use a part for a whole. So if you say under my roof, you mean your house, essentially. So your roof is the example of synecdoche. It's representing the entire house.
Yeah, you get that one. You get a lot of these used in like sporting talk.
Also, when you call someone who's a worker a hand, like a stable hand or all hands on deck, that's also synecdoche.
There's such a pressure, and it's also in news writing, but in sports writing as well, to avoid repetition.
Right.
Absolutely terrified of it. One of the really annoying ones is where when Wimbledon comes around every year, they start referring to it by its postcode because they don't want to keep saying Wimbledon. So they start saying SW19 or whatever. But yeah, SW19, you don't refer to anything else by. I'm making a very tired point here, by the way, that gets made every year in Britain when Wimbledon comes around. Why is it the only thing where we refer to it by its London postcode? But that would be an example of metonymy. Am I right?
Yes. Before we get to the Z's, because we have a couple of Z's.
Oh, yeah.
I should have started our ABCs of literary devices with this one. This is the goofiest one. And it's
okay.
Abecedarius, and it means alphabetical, abecedarius. But this word was in Latin, like it existed in Latin too. It's so goofy, but it's basically a more elaborate acrostic poem. It's a poem or composition where every line or stanza begins with a successive letter of the alphabet. The most famous one that I'm aware of is Chaucer's poem called ABC, also the Prayer of Our Lady, which you should go and read it because it's long and extensive, but every stanza begins with a letter of the alphabet. It's a beautiful poem and it is an elaborate poem, but it also feels like such a like preschool activity.
Yeah, exactly. It is, isn't it? It's just a primary school assignment.
Right.
Abecedarius.
Abecedarius.
How are we spelling that one?
A-B-E-C-E-D-A-R-I-U-S.
Okay, let's get on to Z. We've done very well here.
You know about the big Z one, which is, and the other one is only sort of a Z one anyway.
The big Z.
The big Z.
The Zeugma.
That's what they call me when I go outside.
The big Z.
On the rare occasion I show my face in public.
When they're not calling you Vegesimal. They're calling you the big Z.
Ooh, throwback. We love that one.
Okay, big Z. Zeugma. This is using a word once to govern two or more parts of a sentence in different ways. It's actually quite a difficult concept to explain without just using an example. But a good example is she broke his car and his heart. In that situation, the word broke is working as both a figurative verb, but also a literal verb. It is breaking the car, but it's also figuratively breaking the heart. As an example of zeugma. Another lovely example was from Alexander Pope's Rape of the Lock. He says, "Hear thou, great Anna, whom three realms obey, dost sometimes counsel take and sometimes tea." So you've got the idea of taking counsel, but also taking tea. But the word take only appears once in that expression. Zeugma.
Interestingly, and I want to get back to this because it relates to a fun topic that I think our listeners will really enjoy, but there are two literary devices with that same Greek root. One of them is totally unrelated, but they both mean to yoke or to join. The other one is epizeuxis or epizeuxis. It means like the immediate repetition of a word for emphasis. So in King Lear, when he says never, 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 literally it's just repeating the same word over and over again. In case you needed a fun word for repeating things over and over again. Epizeuxis. But as far as zeugma goes, this relates in my mind to paraprosdokians.
Ooh, okay.
Which I think we should at least briefly address because they're very fun and they make for great like quotable moments. Like they're often affiliated or often associated with Groucho Marx, though he wasn't the first to say most of the ones that are attributed to him, but you'll still see people attributing them to him all the time. I've had a perfectly wonderful evening, but this wasn't it.
Right.
And it's not quite the same, but it has sort of that same energy where you're twisting, like the second part of the sentence changes the interpretation of the first part. And they're meant to be read as jokes, essentially. Dorothy Parker has a ton of them who are attributed to her. One of them is the best way to keep children at home is to make the home atmosphere pleasant and let the air out of the tires. So you get that sort of like twist of expectation. And then the other one, my favorite of hers is you can lead a horticulture, but you can't make her think.
Oh, dear. there's quite a good, quite a rich seam of sort of sexist paraprosdokian, like, take my wife, please.
Yeah. These are all like, I hate my marriage jokes. Which is like, yeah. I think both you and I are like very happily married to our spouses. So like these always seem kind of like outdated humor to me, but they are funny to hear.
Yeah. And they always deliver very dryly, these paraprosdokians. There's a good Bill Hicks one. I sleep 8 hours a day and at least 10 at night.
One that actually I think connects nicely to zeugma is a Mae West quote, "Marriage is a great institution, but I'm not ready for an institution."
Perfect. Yeah, I'm glad that we actually talked about these ones. Paraprosdokian. Yeah.
Zsa Zsa Gabor has one. He taught me housekeeping, and when I divorce, I'll keep the house.
Yeah, I'm enjoying all of these. If I were you, that'd be weird.
Yeah, exactly. I love those.
There's one that's attributed to Stephen Colbert. If I'm reading this graph correctly, I'd be very surprised.
Yes. Oh, these are fun.
Yeah, they are. They are. And paraprosdokian, it literally just means against expectation, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And we've addressed before that they're very similar to garden path sentences. They're just like, they're goofier and funnier and less confusing, which like the garden path sentence is like the sentence, like the old man, the boat, which you have to reinterpret. It's not meant to be that funny. It's just meant to make you reinterpret the sentence.
Yeah. The florist sent the flowers, was pleased.
Right.
Is there another Z one, Jess?
No, that was the Epizeuxis was my other one.
Okay.
Sorry. Okay. It was misleading on that
to
front.
The Z, from the big Z. So actually the big Z didn't deliver a big Z at the end.
I'm so sorry. I went zilch with the pizzazz on the Zs.
Well, me and the big Z, we're going to be back again with you next week for sure for another episode of Words Unraveled. Another fan. No, I can't do it. Can't think of what because
all this go for it. You can do it. You can do it.
Fantastic. I mean, this is the problem. This is the problem, right? You've got the I can't get the swear word out, and it's alliterative as well. So it's like, another another excellent episode of Words.
What a cop out. We love it.